Hello. Thank you all very much for your patience while we got the technical difficulties working out. Also, welcome to another DragonCon. We're DragonCon 2012. It's awesome. I definitely see DragonCon as my home convention here. DragonCon has done a lot of good things for me over the years. I would not be where I am today in cryptography if it were not for DragonCon. I would not have a character named after me in the Dan Brown novel, The Lost Symbol, if it weren't for DragonCon. How many people have come to one of my talks before? Okay, welcome back. New news is this year I was asked by Washington, D.C. to be on the board of directors to build a new National Museum of Cryptography. And thank you. And that would not have happened if it weren't for DragonCon. So I owe a big debt of gratitude. So today we're going to be talking about famous unsolved codes. My name is Ilanka Denon. And I'm going to be giving an update on a couple unsolved codes that are close to my heart. One of them is Kryptos, which is on the left there. That's a sculpture at the center of CIA headquarters. And it's got four codes on it. Three of the four have been solved. The fourth has not been solved yet. It's one of the most famous unsolved codes in the world. And it features in both the book jacket of Dan Brown's novel Da Vinci Code and is also a theme in Dan Brown's next novel, the sequel, which is called The Lost Symbol. On the right, we have something that has nothing whatsoever to do with Kryptos. This is much older than Kryptos. It's called the Voynich Manuscript, and it's centuries old and has many interesting images of plants and hundreds of pages of a bizarre text. We cannot read the text. We do not recognize the alphabet, and we can't even identify any of the plants. So it's definitely one of the more bizarre mysteries out there. So I'll be going over both of these, and then we'll have some time for Q&A. Now, I maintain a list of the world's most famous unsolved codes on my website, ilanka.com. I generally list the most famous unsolved code as something called the Beale Ciphers, which I won't be going over today, but that's something that involves three encrypted messages that were found, I think, supposedly, according to the pamphlet, they were found in Virginia and supposedly detailed the location of many hundreds of pounds of gold and gems. And so many people have tried to decipher these, and there are many holes that have been dug all around this particular town in Virginia trying to find them. I believe that the whole thing is a hoax designed to kind of sell pamphlets, but we can talk more about that later. Then the Voynich Manuscript, I put at number two. Number three, the Dorabella Cipher. This was written by the composer Edward Elgar, who wrote a little message kind of on the back of an envelope to a young woman, and it's never been deciphered. Then the Zodiac Killer Ciphers, the serial killer. Many of you may have heard of those in the newspaper. Somebody who was on a killing rampage in California and was sending these long encrypted messages to newspapers saying, these will give, you know, tell you who I am and how to find me. And we've solved one of them, but we don't know what the others say. And then Kryptos, I put at number five. That's the sculpture that's at the center of CIA headquarters. So I'm going to talk about the Voynich Manuscript first. And there's some new information on it. There was actually a conference in Rome this year to celebrate the 100-year anniversary of when it was found. It was found in 1912, brought to modern attention by a book dealer named Wilfried Voynich. And he purchased it from the Villa Mondragoni, which is southeast of Rome in a town called Frascati. Mondragoni, some of you may remember, it's associated with Pope Gregory. It's where he was when he signed the Gregorian calendar into existence. And we actually met in that room. We had Voynich researchers from all over the world that came in to talk and say, okay, this manuscript was brought to modern attention 100 years ago. What have we found? And the answer is, well, some, but we still don't know what it says. But there has been some new research. For example, we've actually managed to radiocarbon date the vellum that the pages come from. I have a replica of the Voynich manuscript up here that some of you may wish to come up and take a look. I actually went and got all the pages and printed them all out and put them in order, and some of them come into these kind of interesting fold-out shapes. So we can definitely talk more about that after the talk here, and I'll have some pictures here. So this is kind of a close-up of some of the text. We cannot recognize any of the letters, so we've kind of created an alphabet, which we called Voynichese, to at least have something that we can kind of talk about. It really resembles the form of it. We can tell it was written. It was written by pen. The ink comes from that period of time. It was written by someone who was writing from left to right. And it has the structure of language. It has words. It obviously has calligraphy that drawn within. Just hundreds and hundreds of pages, and sometimes these elaborate images of plants. And the plants, someone took great care to create, to draw the flowers, to draw the leaves, to draw the roots. But none of them are things that we can identify. Now, sometimes we can look at and we say, oh, we know the roots, we know that kind of plant, but wait, that kind of plant doesn't have those kinds of leaves. Or hey, we know those leaves, I recognize those leaves, but those leaves are never associated with those kinds of flowers or those kinds of roots. And it just goes on for hundreds and hundreds of pages. And it's like someone was trying to communicate about all these kind of odd plants here. And then we get into this other section where we have these kind of tub-like bathing kind of contraptions. And there's lots of pictures of small naked women that are in these pools. And there's always an indication of water kind of flowing into the pool and then water flowing out of the pool. So maybe it represents mud baths or herbal soaking or something else. But like I said, we just don't know. There's so many questions that come up. For example, this is a flower, and some of you might look at that and say, oh, it sort of looks like a passion flower with five petals, except passion flowers never have five petals. They always have 10 petals. Now, if we were to transcribe this, and I kind of put it in English here at the bottom of the slide, I don't know how many of you can see it. Again, it sort of has a structure of language, but it's like it's teasing. It's not something that we can actually read. Now, there are other books that came from this period of time that were what's called herbal manuscripts, or herbals. And these we can read, and they would be written in Latin, they would be written in Arabic, and they would sort of have some of the same form of words with pictures of plants around in the margins. And some of them were really quite beautiful in the way that they were representing. We can identify these plants, we can read the text, so it's possible that someone was trying to emulate these herbals that they saw, but that even raises more questions. How could someone, I mean, it's not like you could run down to Office Max and buy a bunch of, you know, vellum and stuff. This was expensive material to get these, this kind of parchment, the inks that were necessary for it. So it needed to be someone of means. It needed to be someone who was literate and was able to do these things. So lots of questions there. Here's the passion flower again. And on the left, we have the pictures of real passion flowers. And anybody who knows their flowers knows passion flowers have 10 petals. You know, it just happens. But Voynich, we have something that obviously looks like a passion flower, but five. So does that mean that there was just this odd version of passion flowers around, or does that mean that somebody was kind of deliberately trying to misrepresent flowers? You know, one theory is, and this is, again, just speculation, one theory is that someone was selling ointments and maybe the snake oil of the time. And remember, this is 1400s, 1500s, about 100 years after the plague going through Europe, so people were very concerned about their health. And if you were selling an ointment, the common materials that were in ointments lowered the price of the ointment. So if you wanted a lot of money, you would say, oh, these are very rare herbs that are in these particular ointments. So maybe, just speculation, somebody made this book as a way of saying, look at these plants. See, you've never seen plants like this. You want to buy my, you know, whatever, lotion for something. And because these are so rare, then that would be someone's way of jacking the price up. There's also these pages towards the back of the manuscript that have these, going down the left-hand column, these kinds of tubes. And there's dozens and dozens of these tubes in the manuscript, and we don't know what those are. Now, one theory is that they may be representing early microscopes, and these are some images from museums, 18th century microscopes, a 1676 microscope. But anyone familiar with optics will know that optics didn't really start coming in until around 1600s or so, and we've radiocarboned this manuscript to the early 1400s. So again, a mystery. Each time we come up with something, there's some reason why, no, it couldn't possibly be that. Now someone else has brought up, well, maybe someone, they had this vellum from the early 1400s, and then they just bought like a blank book. For some reason, they got a hold of several blank pages of vellum, but then they drew this later on. That's a possibility. Maybe it happened. But again, why would somebody do that? One theory is that the Emperor Rudolf II, Holy Roman Emperor, he was known for collecting curiosities. He liked unusual things for his collection. So it's possible that someone created a curiosity for him to buy, even though it didn't actually mean anything, but it looked odd. And we do have a record of, well, we have a paper that says that, yes, he did purchase this for a certain amount, which was like 600 gold ducats, which would be about $100,000 in modern currency. This is another page from the manuscript. They fold out, and we get these elaborate designs of rosettes, and it seems to maybe look like a map, maybe some sort of an overhead view of something. But again, in the 1400s, why would you have this odd overhead view? Now, this is something that has a lot of attention to it. Up at the top right, there's something sideways that sort of looks like a castle. And this castle, something interesting about it is in the battlements here, we have these little dips, these dents, and these I think they're called merlons. And this kind of castle, I mean, you can find them all over the world right now, but in the 1400s, there was really only one part of the world that had them, and that was in northern Italy, where they'd have this kind of an architectural element. So it may give a clue to where the manuscript was created. Again, we're having all these kinds of speculation, and people are looking at very small parts of the manuscript trying to find any kind of a clue. This came up in Scientific American a few years ago. Someone said, well, maybe he believes the manuscript was a hoax, and he believes he knows how it was created, and it was with something called a card and grill, which would be where you'd have this large grid of different characters, and then you would move this basically like a 3x5 card with little holes cut in it, and you would say move it, and then you would just write the symbols that were in there, and then you would move it again and write the symbols that were in there. And using that, he said, you could kind of get to something that would look like natural language, even though it wouldn't actually say anything. So, theories about Voynich, well, it could be a hoax, but if it was a hoax, it was a really elaborate hoax. I mean, somebody sitting down and just trying to redraw this thing from beginning to end, it would take a long time. You would have to have a certain amount of calligraphy skill. You'd have to have access to all the vellum. This is high-quality parchment. Like, each page came from one animal, a sheep. The stomach of a sheep was used to make that particular page. So basically an entire flock of sheep was used to create the material that went into the manuscript. It might have been created as a hoax, but there's a question there. Some people have already speculated that it might be an artificial language. Maybe somebody was just mentally ill. Someone was schizophrenic. And some people are known to kind of make up their own languages as they go along. So maybe someone made up their own language, and then they chose to write it into the Voynich manuscript. But again, if someone was, say, mentally unstable or just bored and wanted to do this, again, they must have been someone with means to have access to the vellum and the dyes and the materials necessary. It could be just random, but it does have patterns to it. It doesn't seem like random text. The manuscript has the feel of something that was written by someone who was trying to communicate information to someone else. It doesn't feel like something that was just someone who was mentally ill and was just kind of scribbling things. And it might be a code. It might be encrypted. But the question is, why would it be encrypted? And what was it intended to say? What was it trying to hide? The theory there is perhaps someone who sold some of these herbal ointments had these trade secrets, of family secrets, of what the ingredients were. And so they encrypted things, maybe even encrypted the plants in some way. And then they wrote this down as information for their family, and the family knew the key of how to read the ciphers, but somewhere along the line the key got lost, and so now we just have this book that cannot be read. Again, just a speculation, we don't know for sure. So it could be a lost language, maybe a micronation somewhere in Europe that had this language, but we've never found any other example anywhere of this language or of this alphabet or of those plants. As I said, it might be hiding something to do with alchemy or lenses. Maybe someone did figure out lenses in the 1400s and they were trying to record the kind of things that they saw. Maybe someone was listening to voices and they were transcribing whatever they heard from the angels. Just lots of different theories. Summary of the Voynich manuscript, created in the early 1400s, possibly northern Italy, doesn't match anything we know, but it is called the world's most mysterious manuscript. So any questions on Voynich before I go on to Kryptos? Yes. Do we have a microphone?
I can just project.
Okay, all right, and I'll repeat the question. I can hear you, go ahead. Okay, good question. I should have mentioned that. Where is the manuscript currently? It's currently at the Beinecke Rare Book Library, which is part of Yale University. It's called, it's like MS, there's a number for it. It's like MS-238 or something. I don't remember offhand, sorry.
I wonder, is it
basically structurally uniform? There's no kind of headers or any other sort of structural information that would seem to point to identifiers? Like, you know, for instance, I know a lot of old books have a frontispiece with, you know, publishers, authors, like that.
Okay, good question. The question is there any kind of structure to it, a frontispiece, something, a table of contents or an index? And the answer is no. We don't even really have a title page to it. Now, we're not sure that we have all the pages, though, that existed at the time that it was created. There are page numbers on some of the pages, but we don't know if those were put at the time it was created or possibly by one of the other owners along the way. When Wilfred Voynich found the manuscript in 1912, he found it with some other documents, basically from other scholars over the years saying, I can't read it, I'm sending it to you, can you read it? and along with those was a letter saying, here I'm sending it to you, and I heard from this person who was a teacher there that at one point it was purchased by Emperor Rudolph for this amount of money. On one of the pages there was some black light, almost by accident they found. When they put black light on the page, they found that there was an old signature at the bottom of one of the pages. And that signature was of Tepenich, who was the botanist of Rudolph, which lends credence to the fact that maybe it was, you know, if Rudolph bought it, he would have passed it off to the royal botanist. And we've looked at other books that belong to the botanist, and yes, that's the kind of signature that he tended to have in his books. Also, from the page numbers, some of the pages are missing. And this may have been from those academics who were saying, I can't read it, I'm sending it to you. And obviously they couldn't scan it and email a PDF of the document at the time. So they would like take out a few pages. Here's a sample of a plant page. Here's a sample of just a text page. And it's very possible that some of those pages kind of disappeared over the years. So maybe there was a title page at some point. The structure right now it's sort of like plants, and then it gets into the odd plumbing contraptions. Then there's a series which almost looks like zodiac wheels, and then there's the microscope sort of recipe pages. I could probably talk for hours on just, I'm just trying to give you kind of a basic summary. But we don't even know that was the original order of the pages. They may have been done in more sections, and then somebody may have reorganized them. But it's a good question. We just don't know. Yes, in blonde, yeah. Is there somewhere you can go online to get copies of the pages? The answer is yes. If you go to the Yale University Beinecke Rare Book Library, you can download all the pages. That's what I did to create my replica here. A couple other people over the years have also done scans. There's a hacker group called the Yak, yak.net. They've got links to many of the scans that are on their site as well. I don't think anyone has yet made a coffee table book that has all of the images in it. I mean, it would be a multi-volume book. I'd buy it if it was out there. But I've heard some people talking about someday they're going to do that. Okay, here in the front.
My first impression, especially when you showed the fold-out page, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And if there's a castle in the picture, it would seem to me like, you know, somebody is making a plan for these elaborate gardens, perhaps to even include like healing baths and herbal remedies and things like that. So I'm sure that avenue's been well explored, but I mean, that's just...
Absolutely, and just repeating for the purpose of the recording, very astute observations that it looks perhaps like plants for a garden or plants for some sort of healing area with herbal baths and different kinds of plants. It's, again, possible. We just don't know. Okay. Yes. Someone with the microphone. Great.
You mentioned that it was purchased by an emperor. How long after its creation was it purchased?
Okay. Good question. That was Emperor Rudolph II, who I need to double check. I believe he purchased it in the late 1500s, around 1600 or so. Yeah. Somebody's phone was ringing. Okay. Okay.
It's not unusual for manuscript books to be rebound by later generation or later owner. Does the binding look to be very different time period?
I'm not aware of anyone who specifically investigated the binding. That's a good point. I'm not sure. That's a good question.
How big is it? Is it a folio, a quarto, an elephant volume?
It's the The people who have looked at the pages have divided into folios.
Okay.
And then there's some very good websites that will actually show which page is on the reverse of which page and which is connected and how it was stitched together.
Okay, and that foliation is done in numerals. Normal numerals, the foliation isn't done with like a special code either. It's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Well, there are page numbers that are go from the beginning to the end,
right,
not
okay.
by folio. But again, we're not entirely sure when the page numbers were put in.
Okay.
Yeah. Again, just more quick. It's a good question. We're just not sure. Over here.
You mentioned that they analyzed the paper. Has anyone tried any analysis of the ink?
Yes. There have been some people have looked, good question, and there have been some people that have looked at all the different colors that are in there and which have faded and which have kind of held the intensity of the color. And the dyes that were used were comparable to what was used during that time period. The ink is something called, I believe, iron gall ink, which was very typical of that time period. Some of the colors, like it's been half a millennium now, some of them have held up quite well, some have faded more, but they were all high-quality materials.
Do you know if there's been any analysis done to look at the binding and the aging in the binding to see where possible pages might have been taken out?
There is a website that has looked at all the folios to see which pages are missing. I don't know if they've looked at did they fall out because of the way things were stitched or if they were removed. I don't know if anyone's done that kind of research.
How complete is the provenance? Can we really trace it from owner to owner until, we lose track of it? Or are there gaps with where it's disappeared?
That's a really good question. There was a lot of attention to that at the gathering that we had at the Mondragone. We know, of course, that Voynich purchased it in 1912. As for why it was in the Villa Mondragone, we believe that it went. And it had a letter that said, I heard that it was it was a letter, I can't remember, written to a scholar named Athanasius Kircher. And so we know that it was in the Mondragone. We believe it got there, if it went from Emperor Rudolf to his botanist, and then the botanist materials, and then we kind of tracked which way the wars came through, and then materials that were in this library were then stored here, and then it finally went off to the Vatican because everything kind of accumulates at the Vatican. We found a couple other letters in the Vatican that refer to it, but before this alleged purchase by Emperor Rudolf, we have no idea where it was. It's just speculation, but good question.
Are there any other sorts of encoded manuscripts from the same period that have the same format or are just any kind of sort of like examples of what you said, things that were encoded for families, things like that it can compare to?
Yes, and codes were and ciphers were very popular, especially among the more intellectual elite. They would often create codes and ciphers kind of as hobbies, like we do with recreation, like you'll see codes in the newspaper. So we've looked at the types of ciphers that might have been there. Actually, a team was put together to analyze the ciphers here. It was Friedman's team, and his team had actually worked on military codes, actually cracked the Japanese cipher. And as a recreation, every so often they'd get together and say, okay, we can crack these military ciphers. Let's go see if we can go crack this, and then they'd take a look at something. And they put the full force of the military code-breaking effort onto the Voynich manuscript. Couldn't solve it. So I don't think it's any kind of standard cipher system. Their guess when they were done was that it was some sort of artificial language. But again, just guess. Up front here we have. We'll do maybe two more questions and then I'll go on to cryptos. Okay.
Yes, I was wondering if there is any kind of electronic form of the manuscript available online you might know of, something you could apply computer ciphers mm-hmm. and analysis to, and
yeah.
where you might get that.
Yeah, Friedman's team did that. This was back when computers were key punch cards, and they actually came up with this Voynichese language just so that it could be keyed into computers, and you can get those complete downloads online and do any kind of statistical analysis you want to it. There's the Voynichese language. There's different people that debate on which character in Voynichi's is representing, how to represent it. And it's tricky, because imagine that you're a space alien and you're looking at the English language, handwritten English language, and you see, for example, the letter M. Well, you don't know, is that one letter, or is it two letters, you know, two N's next to it, or is it three, you know, does each loop, you don't know where a letter starts and where it stops. And, you know, if someone has a T with, you know, with a cross T, does, you know, is the cross a separate letter? Is the what goes up one letter, what's down? So even putting it onto a computer, there was debates about where to do the breaks between letters. So more statistical analysis is always welcome. One more Voynich question, and then I'll go on to cryptos.
Yes, so you mentioned that there are certain things that point to it maybe being in northern Italy, and then also that several of the plants, like there was one that looked like a passion flower but kind of off. And I guess I was wondering, of the parts of plants you can identify, are they all plants that would be in at least one area, if not northern Italy somewhere? Or does it look like, oh, well, that looks like this plant that was in Italy, but you can only find this thing in Africa. What's that doing there?
All right, good question. All the plants, the commonalities that we tend to find is that they tend to be the kinds of things that could be cultivated. There's nothing that looks like a food plant that's in there. There's nothing that looks like a tree, an unambiguous tree. Everything that's there could be the kind of thing that would grow in Italy or could have been cultivated in Italy if it was, say, brought by a ship from some other part of the world. I mean, there's a couple plants that have sort of fantastic elements to it. There's like some plants that have, looks like snakes kind of coiled through the roots. There's a plant that has what looks like eagle talons as part of it. I think there's one with sort of a dragon kind of incorporated as part of the plants. But generally, they look like plants. Yeah, just plants. Almost like if you took a bunch of roots and a bunch of plants and a bunch of flowers and then you just slid things back and forth and then you did sort of this kind of mix and match method, which may have been what was done. Several of the plants, it looks like you have roots and then it looks like the roots were cut and then some other plant was stuck on top of it, maybe like a cutting, which maybe if someone was interested in alchemy, and alchemy was all about taking different elements and combining them in different ways, somebody may have been playing with some sort of alchemical method of plants, saying, okay, we're going to take the root of this plant, we're going to cut it, and we're going to put this other plant and come up with something else, which, again, why would they do this? For medicinal purposes, for astrological purposes? We don't know. Lots of questions. Okay, good questions. I'll go on to cryptos, and then if anyone still has Voynich questions, we can cover them at the end. Okay, cryptos is probably the one that the cipher I've spent the most time on of all the different unsolved codes around the world. It is at the center of CIA headquarters in Langley, Virginia. It was installed there in 1990 by an artist named Jim Sanborn. He's still alive. He was born in 1945 in Washington, D.C. It was a challenge to the employees of the CIA. It has four ciphers on it. Three of the four have been solved. The fourth has not been solved yet. One of the most famous unsolved codes in the world. I had the opportunity to visit Cryptos at one point. I was giving a talk about Al-Qaeda codes shortly after the September 11th attacks. And I managed to get some rubbings of the sculpture. So each of these rubbings was done on a standard 8.5 by 11 piece of paper, kind of giving an idea of the scale of the different letters. The NSA, which is the National Security Agency, which is really the cipher element of the United States government, has tried to crack the codes on Cryptos. Shortly after Cryptos was installed, the CIA's Deputy Director, Admiral William Studeman, went to the NSA, kind of CIA-NSA rivalry, saying, okay, you guys are so hot, let's see how hot you are. And so the NSA's director at the time, Vice Admiral John Mike McConnell, he took up the challenge, and they put together a team at the NSA, and they put the government computers onto the Cryptos ciphers. I'll tell you what the Cryptos ciphers say in a few slides, but they put the computer attack on it, and they did solve the first three parts by late 1992, but they couldn't solve K4. And the reason that they gave for not solving K4 is because it was very short. It was only 97 characters long. Now, if this kind of cipher would have happened like in the wild in wartime, what they would do is they would stamp it, needs more collection. We need more ciphers of this type in order to run the computer models on it in order to solve it. Some of you may have heard of the World War II Enigma ciphers. And the Allies, we were able to solve those ciphers, but we needed large amounts of cipher text to work with. And then we would look for what's called cribs and finding little bits and pieces. For example, if we knew that there was a certain station at a certain spot that was always transmitting at 7 o'clock in the morning, always transmitted an encrypted message, and we knew that it was a weather station. Well, you would know that weather reports tend to be pretty common. You know, is it sunny? Is it raining? What is the temperature? What is the wind? So we would gather that information and say, okay, what was the weather on this day? Okay, it was sunny. So somewhere in this message, some of that plain text is going to say sunny, you know, chance of thunderstorms. And if we have that kind of large amount, then we can kind of take things apart. But with Kryptos, that last part, 97 characters, is really short, which makes it much, much more difficult. Now, I've tried to get a hold of the National Security Agency report from 1992. I actually filed a Freedom of Information Act request to try and get it, which is me bumping up against the government bureaucracy. So in March 2010, I filed my request related to the NSA team that was formed to solve the puzzles of the crypto sculpture. So I got a reply back. April 2010. They asked me if I was willing to pay a search fee. I said yes. In June 2010, I got an answer saying, okay, the search was completed. I was in the first-in, first-out processing queue for non-personal easy cases, but since there were several cases ahead of mine, they were unable to respond within 20 days. I said, no problem. So I wait 6 months. I write back. I say, hey, how's my FOIA going? And I get a nice, very polite letter saying, the referenced case is actively being worked and in fact has already made it through the first level of review. There are additional review and approval stages, and there are other cases ahead of yours, so it may be some time before you receive the response. And I sent a polite letter back. 5 months later, I write back and I say, hey, how's my FOIA going? And I get a nice letter back saying, the FOIA case is in the final approval stages. I wait another 6 months, I write back, and then I get, your FOIA case is in the final approval stages. There are a number of cases ahead of yours in that queue. So I've been continuing to write. I always get these nice letters saying, I'm in the final approval stages. So it's been over 2 years now. I've heard through the grapevine that this is often what happens with Freedom of Information Act request, is that if they don't want to fill it, they're just going to say you're in final review stages, and you just never hear back from them. But I'm going to continue to push, and if necessary, I'm going to write to my congressman. And now that I am on the board of directors for the National Security Agency National Cryptography Museum, I will see if possibly that might help me. After DragonCon, I'm actually driving up to Washington, D.C. for the next board of directors meeting. And I have a fun story I tell about that. This will be my second board of directors meeting for the new crypto museum. At the first meeting, and it's a bunch of old, very high-powered people in the government, many retired generals, ex-directors of the NSA, ex-director of the CIA. And after the meeting, you know, one of the members of the board of directors came up and he said, you know, Ilanka, you're the first time we've had a non-government insider on the board. And I said, oh, okay, that's cool. He said, before there were people who were supposedly outsiders, but they were really undercover, pretending to be outsiders, but they were really insiders. So you're the first real outsider. So we'll see if I can kind of shake things up a bit now that I'm there. So Kryptos. So once I started researching it, I looked into not only what the sculpture said and who created it, but what other kinds of sculptures that the artist had created. And Jim Sanborn, I found it that after he'd created Kryptos, he'd created another sculpture called the Untitled Kryptos piece, which he'd sold to a private collector. And I tracked this down. It's currently in the backyard of a dot-com millionaire in California. And it has a lot of the same text of Kryptos, and it also has Cyrillic text, Russian text, encrypted on the other side. We have since solved these things. We know what they say. And the Russian encrypted text is also on another of Sanborn's sculptures, which is called the Cyrillic Projector. This one is at the University of North Carolina, Charlotte, if anyone's been there. Is Randall Bullig here? He actually went out and took some pictures of the sculpture to help us transcribe it and get this thing solved. These are just some differences, and I'll get to the slides here where we're going to talk about what crypto says here. There are some differences between what's on the untitled Kryptos piece and what's on the actual Kryptos sculpture. And one is that there's these two dots that are on the untitled sculpture. These dots exist. It's the same text as on Kryptos. All the letters are identical to what's on Kryptos, but the untitled piece has got these extra two dots. We don't know why. All right, so Kryptos, coming back here, and on two sides, or there's four plates. Two of the plates have ciphers on them, and the other two are what's called a visionnaire table. This is a type of cryptographic system named after Blaise de Visionnaire, though he actually wasn't the one that came up with this particular system. There's several systems, and they're all kind of mushed together. So to make a visionary table, well, first you want to start, for this variation, you want to start with what's called a cipher alphabet. So you take the letters of the alphabet, A through Z, and then you take a key. In this case, we're taking the word cryptos, and you take the letters of cryptos out of the alphabet, and you put them over at the left, and then you have all the other the rest of the letters over at the right. So you end up still with 26 letters in the alphabet, just in a different order. They're sort of scrambled, but scrambled in a way that you can easily recreate if needed. All right. And then you take that cipher alphabet, and then if you shift each row by one, so you keep repeating the cipher alphabet, but the next one down you just shift it over by one, next one down you shift it over by one. So you end up with this tableau where you get, let me see if I can do this because the computer, so this letter, this one starts with K, this one starts with R. So there's a couple artifacts here. One is that you get these nice diagonals. So you can see like all the Q's go down on diagonals and the X's and the Z's. Also, you can read one word cryptos. Cryptos, by the way, is Greek for the word hidden. It's one of the roots for the word cryptography, which means cryptos and grapheme, hidden writing. So you have cryptos here, and you also, if you come down this column, you can also read the word cryptos there. So this is just one single key. But now the actual sculpture used a different system where you take the crypto cipher alphabet, but then you have a different keyword that's going down the left-hand side. In this case, the second key was the word palimpsest. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. I read it a lot, but I don't often say it. A palimpsest is a word for a scroll that has had one message written on it. Then that message was scraped off, and another message was written on that same scroll, so that you can see bits of the old message showing through as you're reading the second message. Palimpsest can also be used to refer to other things besides something written. For example, the city of Rome can be referred to as a palimpsest, because if you're standing on a street corner in Rome and you might be looking at a modern office building, but next to it you're going to be seeing from medieval times a medieval church next to that building, and next to that you might see Roman ruins. So the time of Rome showing through into modern times. So that's why they might say Rome is a palimpsest. The word palimpsest might be a clue for solving part four. We don't know. We found other things where there might be like letters showing through. But again, we just have lots and lots of speculation about it. Okay, so if we use this with cryptos and palimpsest, and we're going to apply this to part one of cryptos. Part one is these two lines that are at the top of this plate. Okay, and then we take our grid here. So again, we have cryptos here, and then palimpsest coming down the left-hand column. And the first letters on cryptos were E-M-U-F-P. H-Z. So we take each one of those ciphertext letters and we put it here. So we have E, M, U, F, P, and going on. So then to get them to plain text, we go up. So E becomes a B, M becomes an E, U becomes a T, F over here becomes a W. So E, M, U, F, P, H, Z becomes B, E, T, W, E, E, N, between. And if you keep going like that and you keep repeating the word palimpsest as you go down, then you can get the entire what's called plain text coming out from those ciphertexts. Wasn't me. Okay. All right. So this is the ciphertext.
And works from
the key with using the keys of
over here as a comma.
Okay. Another technical difficulty, sorry.
Take six down all the way.
Scott's using his director voice. Okay, all right. So using the keys of cryptos and palimpsest, we come up with a plain text of between subtle shading and the absence of light lies the nuance of illusion. Now you see it says occlusion there. There's a Q there. Is that a typo on the slide? No, it's a typo on the sculpture. But I've asked Sanborn, I said, was it a mistake? Was it an error? And he said, no. He said, it's deliberate. But it's not what it is that's so important. It's where it is. It's the orientation or the positioning. We don't know what that means, but very intriguing. Now, the letter that's there where the Q is, to create a Q in that spot, the Q is the plain text. The ciphertext letter is a K in that particular spot on the sculpture. Part two starts at the third row here, VFPJ. And part two actually goes all the way down to the bottom of this plate.
Can I ask a question?
Sure, question.
How do you know which one's part one, part two, part three?
We know now because as we're doing the deciphering, we know that if we're using one cipher system for the first two lines, we get nice plain text for the first two lines, and then it just turns into garbage text. We need to switch the cipher system. When it was being solved, we didn't know. And a lot of code solving is just kind of guesswork, and then you keep teasing it out. It's like untangling a ball of yarn or something. It's like, this didn't work. Okay, this didn't work. In fact, looking at this slide, this is ciphertext for part two. The first person to solve it was, aside from the NSA, because they didn't announce their solution, the first person that was known to have solved it was a CIA analyst named David Stein. And he solved it in 1998. And then 1999, there was a non-government computer scientist named Jim Gloogly. And he solved the first three parts and announced it on a news group. And then that became international news in 1999. Then the CIA came forward and said, OK, well, we had someone who solved it a year ago. His name was David Stein. And then the NSA came forward and said, well, we have people that solved it too, but we're not going to tell you who and we're not going to tell you when, which is very NSA. The joke in Washington, D.C. is that National Security Agency, NSA, really stands for no such agency. But eventually it did come out, and we know that it was that team in 1992 that was working on it and it solved the first three parts but didn't solve the fourth part. So when David Stein was working on it, what he said is that when he was looking at it, and he spent many afternoons on his own time, pencil and paper, and what he noticed is that these letters DQM here, and then he noticed over here was DQM as well. And so he assumed that maybe those might be a common three-letter word in the English language. Most common three-letter word is the. Good. And now there's a polyalphabetic system, which doesn't mean that every D would be a T, but it could mean that every D at a period of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, every D at a period of 8 might be a T, and that every Q at a period of 8 there might be an H, and that every M at a period of 8 might be an E. What you do is you make 8 different alphabets, and then you do a frequency analysis on each of those 8, and then you're teasing. You know, you're getting a little bit here and a little bit here. It was T-H-E, it wasn't the and the, it was something else, but I'll show you on the next slide. Now, Sanborn did say that there was an error on the sculpture. He announced this a few years ago, and he said that he'd omitted a letter down here, which is that S. And I'll talk about the corrected ciphertext in a minute. But going from this ciphertext, using, again, the same method of, instead of cryptos and palimpsest, we have cryptos and now the word abscissa. Abscissa is a mathematical term. It means the x-coordinate on a graph. And the plain text is, it was totally invisible. How's that possible? They used the Earth's magnetic field, X. The information was gathered and transmitted underground to an unknown location, X. Does Langley know about this? They should. It's buried out there somewhere, X. Who knows the exact location? Only WW. This was his last message, X. 38 degrees, 57 minutes, 6.5 seconds north, 77 degrees, 8 minutes, 44 seconds west, ID by Rose. Or at least we thought it said ID by Rose until Sanborn came forward and said, oh, oops, sorry, I left out a letter. Which meant that we needed to shift everything. And when we shift everything, it completely changes what the letters are because of this polyalphabetic system. So at the end, instead of saying ID by Rose, what it should say is X, layer 2, which, of course, is much more clear. All right. So I'll go over where we think those latitude and longitude coordinates point to. Also, I'll mention this, the word underground. Again, we have a deliberate misspelling here. Instead of O-U-N-D, it says U-U-N-D. And the letter on the sculpture that was changed. So this, the plain text is a U. The ciphertext at that spot is the letter R, which we find intriguing because now we have two errors, one with a ciphertext K, another with a ciphertext R. The name of the sculpture is Cryptos, K-R. We spent a lot of time looking to see is there a Y-P-T-O-S somewhere else on the sculpture, but we haven't found it. But this would also tie into that palimpsest things, possibly of letters showing through, just things we're looking at. So part three uses a completely different system, starts at the top of this plate, and there's some letters out of alignment here, but I'll go into those. So part three starts at the top of this plate, goes down to about here, about four lines from the bottom. And here, and this ties into the question that you asked about how do we know, when we're looking at the ciphertext here, an experienced cryptanalyst will look at this and see, aha, the distribution is different. And people may look at this and you can see it looks different from the ciphertext of the others. You're seeing lots of vowels here. You're seeing E's and T's and A's and I's and O's, not so many Q's and X's and Z's. And that means that often, it means that this is a different type of cryptographic system. Instead of a substitution system in the first two parts, this is a transposition system. All of the letters of the plaintext message are here, they've just been rearranged in some way. So one potential way is if you take all of part three and you line it up, this is a method I came up with, and you get it into nice even rows and columns here, and then you start in the middle here with this S, and then you count down. 1, 2, 3, and then wrap around 4, you get to an L. Count down another 4. 1, 2, 3, 4, you get an O. 1, 2, 3, 4, you get to a W. 1, 2, 3, 4, you get to an L. So S-L-O-W-L-Y, slowly. All right, so you get a plain text message. And you keep doing that. You get these wonderful diagonals. You can pull out the entire message that way. All right. And get my mouse back. Slowly, desperately. So the plain text for part three is slowly, desperately, slowly, the remains of passage debris that encumbered the lower part of the doorway was removed. With trembling hands, I made a tiny breach in the upper left-hand corner. And then, widening the hole a little, I inserted the candle and peered in. The hot air escaping from the chamber caused the flame to flicker, but presently details of the room within emerged from the mist. X. Can you see anything? Q. Anyone recognize that? King Tut's tomb, right? This is a paraphrased extract from the diary of Howard Carter on November 26, 1922, the day that he discovered King Tut's tomb. This was a book that had been written by written by Howard Carter, read by Jim Sanborn when he was a boy, and he'd been very intrigued by that. And he thought that what he has said is that he liked it because he felt this idea of discovering something buried was similar to the idea of solving a message, of you know, kind of going into the darkness and light gradually illuminating a plain text message. Then we have part four, 97 characters here. Can't tell you what it says because we don't know. Nobody knows. Some people said, oh, there must be somebody in the government that has solved this. And I don't think so, because I've got enough contacts in the government now that I think if it was solved, somebody would have come up and kind of, hey, you know, okay, you know, we got it. You know, I'm not going to tell you, but we got it. But nope. I know there's a lot of work that's been put into it. I know that there are pretty much several government groups that are designed to crack codes. Once they've written their software on how to crack codes, they'll put that software onto things such as the Voynich manuscript or such as Kryptos, just to see what they can come up with, and then they'll publish their reports about it on the classified wikis, you know, that the government has. So that's Kryptos. And now the coordinates, 38 degrees, 57, 6.5 seconds. All right. Is anyone here a geocacher? No? Okay. So if you know, from geocaching, you probably know that where it says 6.5 seconds north, a tenth of a second of latitude is a very specific location, about 10 feet across. And so it's interesting that he put 6.5 seconds north, not 6 seconds, not 7 seconds, 6.5 seconds north. So obviously pointing to a specific location. Did you have a quick question? Or? Actually, let's hold the question, and we'll come back to it. Is that okay? All right. So we found that it points to the general location of CIA headquarters. So this is the original headquarters building, and this is the new headquarters building. And it was when the new headquarters building was commissioned in the 1980s that they decided that they wanted to have art to go around the building. And that's when they commissioned Jim Sanborn to create the crypto sculpture. This building with the white funny-shaped roof in the middle, this is the cafeteria. There's a courtyard here. Sanborn designed most of this courtyard. He also designed some art out in front of the new headquarters building. Kryptos is basically in the top corner of this courtyard. Now, we believe that the latitude and longitude point also to that courtyard. Like I said, 6.5 seconds north. It doesn't point to Kryptos. It points to an area about 150 feet southeast of Kryptos. So here's another image. Again, here's the... here's the building, the cafeteria, and the new headquarters building. We have a nice atrium you can walk through with a glass ceiling. And Kryptos is this little squiggle up here. Sanborn designed Kryptos. He designed this entire semicircular courtyard. There's a duck pond there and some other rock formations over here. Here's another image. I love Google Images maps. I can just go in and like look inside CIA headquarters. So again, we have Kryptos here. And there's a round pool at the base of Kryptos. Here's another close-up of the duck pond and these slabs. And you see these slabs kind of point in a line, pointing at Kryptos. And he also, Sanborn also did these slabs out here, which are also in this diagonal line. These slabs are big, thick slabs that are pushed up sort of like a geological seam. And in between the slabs, we have these sheets of copper with Morse code messages on them. So again, better close-up here. We have the lampposts, and we have these slabs here. There's also a compass rose. There's a tiny little slab here, which doesn't have any Morse code on it, which may or not be related to the mystery. We don't know. These are some of the Morse code messages. There's also a magnetic lodestone that's part of it, and an engraved compass rose, but which is not pointing towards north. The needle is not pointing towards north. And so we've spent some time kind of looking at where things are pointing to see what that has to do. He's done other sculptures as well that also use engraved compass roses. It was part of the theme of his work at the time, as he liked magnetism. He liked making invisible forces visible. So many of his gallery installations have to do with magnets or the Coriolis force. He would have things like you'd walk into a gallery and there would be hundreds of threads hanging from the ceiling. Each one would have a needle, and all the needles would be pointing at a lodestone on the far side of the gallery. And it was his way of showing the invisible lines of magnetic force that were going through and showing how, you couldn't see them, but they were all definitely affecting all of those needles. So he put many compass roses. He put three compass roses around the D.C. area. And yes, we've gone to those three compass roses and saw where they were pointing to see if they intersect anywhere, which would have been cool, but that wasn't what he did. Okay, so I think I have another one here. So again, we have Kryptos, and we have the blocks here and a pond there, and then these line there. And then this is that unmarked block, what we call the triangle block. No Morse code on it. It does have these kind of grooves, which may be from the quarrying process, but it has a very specific kind of a pyramid shape. Might be related to the puzzle, might not. We don't know. Other things that we've noticed is that on the Visionaire tableau side of Kryptos, where you have these diagonal letters, each line ends with a certain letter, and they don't go in order. It should end with the same letter here. So as we have, say, Kryptos A B C D F G H I J L, it goes E F G H I L L. This line should end with a J, but ends with an L. So we have two lines that end with L. Is it related to the cipher? Is it something he did deliberately? And we don't know. It's possible. One of the reasons we think it might be deliberate is because he did put a clue to solving a cipher on another one of his sculptures. Remember I said he had one at Charlotte, North Carolina, the Cyrillic projector. So this is a tube. It's about 12 feet tall, and there's a light on the inside of it that beams encrypted text all around the courtyard between the Friday and the Fretwell buildings at UNC Charlotte. And it's Russian text. But if you go there and you stand there and you look, we know from having solved the cipher now, which was really difficult because we had all these pictures of a cylindrical sculpture that we had to transcribe, and it was Russian text that was backwards. And it just took a long, long time to do the transcript. But if you go there and you stand there and you look and you know Cyrillic, you'll see Cyrillic everywhere, and then you'll see a word that is not Cyrillic. Anyone who knows the Russian alphabet will know there's no D in the Cyrillic alphabet. There's no S in the Cyrillic alphabet. So these are Latin letters spelling out what looks like a word, Medusa, Medusa. And Medusa actually is one of the keys for solving the cipher on the Cyrillic projector. There were two keys. It was similar. It was a Visionaire system. But instead of like Kryptos and Palimpsest, it was Tien and Medusa, written in Cyrillic. So there's one of the keys there. So possibly, we're thinking, okay, so this was one of the keys to solving the sculpture. Where did this word come from where it was projected? And one of the, another DragonCon attendee, John Wilson, who went out there, actually noticed. Is John here? Seeing? Okay. John noticed when he went out there is that the word Medusa came from the third line from the bottom on this plate. And he saw something. He saw that on that third line, there's an extra bolt. Now, it's hard to see from here, but if you look from the other side, it's really clear. There's an extra bolt there. And it's the only extra bolt like that on the entire sculpture. So it's possible that Sanborn put it there as a way of drawing the eyes to that line to say, hey, here's a key. Now, we've looked at cryptos to see if we can see any extra bolts. We haven't. But possibly that extra L is pointing to something. Again, we don't know. This is Ed Scheidt. Ed is he was the chairman of the CI Cryptographic Center. He's the one who taught Sanborn about ciphers. So he designed the systems that were used on cryptos, and then Sanborn came up with the messages to be encrypted, encrypted them, and then carved them into the sculpture. Scheidt has said that part four was done in a more difficult system, and he did things to mask the English. And he said this several times. We've gone out to dinner with, I bought him drinks, you know, trying to get him talking. Yeah. And you know, any little bit of information we can get. And he keeps saying this thing about masking the English. He said, we solved the first three parts. We had the benefits of the English language, the patterns of the English language. Now, he said that he and Jim did talk about ways to make the code really difficult to solve. They could have, you know, the plain text could have been in ancient Babylonian or some language, some sort of dead language. But he said, no, part four, the answer is in English, and it is solvable. But he did things to mask the English. And we're still not sure what that means. It was kind of. He also said he used a little bit of stego, a little bit of steganography, which is a way of hiding a message. So in 2010, so this is 20 years after the sculpture was created, Sanborn did offer a hint. He called up the New York Times and said he's also getting stalkers, which is something. I think he wants it solved so he doesn't get stalkers anymore. He announces to the New York Times, and he said that in part four, where these letters are, NYPVTT, that they come down to the plain text, which is Berlin. He said it's Berlin the city. It's not a combination of two words like number line or amber link or something. It is Berlin. So that was a flurry of activity. So we went and we did a bunch of computer analysis to see, okay, if we used a visionary system with pairs of keywords like cryptos nepsis or cryptos and palimpsest, could we come up with a pair of words that would generate the word Berlin at that location? And we did. And they were intriguing words, which were the words shifted and binary, which plausible. I'm like, okay. And so we thought maybe we're onto something. And then we found out that there were a lot of other pairs of words that would do it as well. All right, so you can see it puts Berlin at the exact right spot. We found out lots of other pairs of words would do the same thing, like subcompact Gorky, algorithmic gratefulness, drifts mobilized, brain pan non-domesticated. Yeah, so maybe shifted binary means something, maybe not. But it is just at least gives us that little bit more insight onto part four. All right. And like I said, we're looking at different words, and we've looked at, Berlin. Well, could we look at what kind of word would happen after Berlin? Normally if you saw the word Berlin, the next word might be wall or Berlin or Berlin Tunnel. And the CIA did have a lot to do with Berlin during the Cold War. And what would be before Berlin? West Berlin, East Berlin. So these are other things we're looking at. Just some other stuff about cryptos. There are these letters that are out of alignment at the beginning of part three. Again, Sanborn has said that they were deliberate. It wasn't an accident. And he says that they're important. But, what they might mean, we don't know. Also, something intriguing he said is that normally I was showing this picture of cryptos. And Sanborn corrected me. He says, you keep showing it from the wrong angle. And I said, what? He said, you're showing it from the side. That's an ugly view. I'm like, what? He said, no, this is the front. So I'm, for whatever that might mean, does this mean that this cross might mean something, north, south, east, west? Maybe the way that the rocks are aligned. I've talked to members of his extended family, and they say from everything they know of him, if he put a rock somewhere in a certain orientation, he meant for that rock to be there in that particular orientation. So. There you go. There's the front of cryptos, not the side. We've done some research. There is a segment of the Berlin Wall that's at CIA grounds. Now, cryptos was installed. Sanborn got the gig to do it in 1988, and then he installed it in 1990. The Berlin Wall fell in November 1989 in the middle of this process. And then a Berlin Wall monument was dedicated at the CIA in December 1992. So it's possible that Sanborn knew about this new monument that was going to be there, and the latitude and longitude coordinates were in some way meant to point to where the Berlin Wall Monument was supposed to be, but then it didn't actually get put there. It got put somewhere else. Maybe. We don't know. Again, just more speculation. Where it is now, again, we have Kryptos up in this corner, and the actual Berlin Wall Monument is down around here. But maybe it was supposed to be placed over here where the coordinates point to. Again, we don't know. So, ciphertext. So a little bit about Kryptos and pop culture. I mentioned that Dan Brown used it. If you have the original American version hardcover of the Da Vinci Code, Dan Brown hid 5 puzzles in the artwork of the book jacket. 2 of them refer to Kryptos. And one of them is here in the back art. There's kind of tear portion here. Really faint, it says only WW knows. And WW, by the way, refers to William Webster, who was the director of the CIA at the time that the sculpture was installed. Right. And then also on the back of the Da Vinci Code, really faint here, light red on dark red, are some numbers, backwards numbers, that say 37 degrees, 57 minutes, 6.5 seconds north, 77 degrees, 8 minutes, 44 seconds west. Now, those of you with good memories may say, wait a minute, it says 37 degrees, and you said that Kryptos said 38 degrees. And you're right, because, and I talked to Dan Brown, because I helped him with the research for the lost symbol, and I said, how come it says 37 on Da Vinci Code when Kryptos says 38? And he just said, the discrepancy is intentional. All right, what does that mean? And you wouldn't, and then I talked to his publisher because we were getting ready for the lead up to the launch of Lost Symbol. I said, hey, by the way, you know on the book jacket where it said 37 degrees and Kryptos really said 38? Publisher said, yeah, the discrepancy is intentional. So they got their stories combined, you know, kind of synchronized, but still don't know what that means or what he was going to do with that. So this is Lost Symbol. It takes place in Washington, D.C. I'm going to be giving a talk about the Lost Symbol and about my links to the book and a little bit about Freemasonry as well. That's going to be later on in DragonCon. I don't remember exactly. Oh, wait, I have a thing here that says I will be speaking about Freemasonry and the Lost Symbol on Sunday at 1 p.m. here in this very same room. Okay. And so why hasn't K4 been solved yet? Well, one, it's short. It's possible that there's a key that's on CIA grounds. Kryptos was never designed as a challenge to the public. It was a challenge to the employees at the CIA. So maybe there's something there that we need access to, some piece of artwork or, you know, who knows. It's possible we've missed something. It's possible we've been misdirected. Like Scheidt keeps saying the answer is in English. Maybe the answer is in French or Spanish or Greek. We don't know. It's also possible they screwed it up. And it's just, you know, it might have a mistake. It might be unsolvable. This has happened many times in history. Someone designs a cipher, and then they forget how they made it, and it just remains unsolvable. However, Sanborn did go to the trouble of checking his work, and he did announce the mistake that he knew about. And when I've gone out drinking with Ed Scheidt, and I've pushed him, and I said, how do you know? And I ask him, do you know what it says? And he gets kind of cagey, and, you know, maybe he does, maybe he doesn't. I said, well, yeah, you know, has anyone checked it? I mean, maybe Sanborn screwed it up. Maybe it's not solvable. And Scheidt was, it's solvable. And I'm like, oh, okay. He said, I know it's done right. Okay, all right. So, Kryptos, 4 sections of code, you know, it's short, it might be screwed up, we don't know, but they've said it's solvable. Both Sanborn and Scheidt have said it's solvable. My own goal is not necessarily to solve it. I want to see it solved, and if I can help see it solved by sharing as much information as possible, then great. That's my assistance to the effort here. Anyone who wants to get more involved with solving Kryptos, we do have a Yahoo group. You can join by sending an email to kryptos-subscribe@yahoogroups.com. You can go to my website, ilanka.com/kryptos. It's a very popular website. Between that and my Unsolved Codes page, I've gotten over 4 million page views so far. So it's a big topic in pop culture. You can contact me on IMs or Google. There's also some good videos out there, like PBS, Nova Science Now did a nice segment on Kryptos. Also, after Brown's Lost Symbol book came out, we did The Secrets of the Lost Symbol, which discusses the fact and fiction of the Lost Symbol. There's about 30 different academics writing about what Dan Brown got right, what he got wrong, mostly what he got wrong. and so there's more information about Kryptos there. And any questions on Kryptos? Yes, in the back. Part 1 and 2, there's an obvious error in there. The monster, obvious one, number 3. Okay, so there was an obvious error in part one, obvious error in part two. Did part three have an obvious error? There was an error where it slowly, desperately was misspelled. However, when I've asked Sanborn about that, when I asked him about the first two errors, and I said, does it mean something? And he's always like, well, maybe, maybe not. He's very cagey. When I asked him about desperately, he gets this like, he just screwed up. Because we've looked at other sculptures that he created, and he's done another one with that slowly part, and he spelled it correctly on the other sculpture.
If we got a lost camera,
oh, we have a lost camera, if anyone... Lost camera. Okay. All right. Any other Kryptos questions? Okay. Okay, good question. I'm not sure her microphone was on, but has the artist made any plans to finally let the answer be known? And you know, when I asked Sanborn about this, he said he wants to die knowing that it's unsolved, to which I've told him I have members of the Kryptos group that can make that happen for him. but then he's also gave a clue to the New York Times, so he's kind of ambivalent about it. What he's done is he's put the answer into two safe deposit boxes, one on the West Coast, one on the East Coast, and he's given the keys to these boxes to two members of his extended family, one to his girlfriend, another who's like a member of extended family. And it's an interesting question. How do you give someone access to the answer without giving them the answer? And what he's done is he's given each of them something called a K4 test. So if someone were to go to his girlfriend, Jay, and say, Jay, I've solved part four, she is to ask them, give them a challenge, like, what is the 22nd letter? And if they answer correctly, well, what is the 56th letter? And if they answer again, if they answer enough correctly, then she goes in the safe deposit box and opens it up. That way she knows how to test whether they have the answer without actually herself knowing the answer. Sanborn has also set up a website. I have a link on mine that if someone thinks they've solved it, I think it's called cryptosclue.com, but I'm not certain, where if someone thinks they've solved it, they can go and they type in, these are the first 10 letters of it. I have people writing to me probably about a few times a month saying they've solved Kryptos Part 4. And it's going to be hoaxers. It's going to be people who are schizophrenic or people who are well-meaning and think they've solved something. I found the word the. Okay, here, you solved the rest. You know, I get that a lot. And if someone says they've solved it, I often tell them, okay, give me a portion of the plain text. And this will date stamp it, and CC me, you know, CC the other directors of the Kryptos group, or probably any place you want, say, here's a portion of the plain text. And then once it's out there and date stamped, then share the method. And then if other people can replicate what you did, and we can get the full plain text, then we'll go and do a press release and we'll put it out there. So far, no one's been able to do that. A lot of people have said they've solved it. No one's been able to come up with a full plain text.
Okay, one more question.
Yeah.
Is there any indication that it can be solved through analysis and that it's not a one-time pad or a book cipher or something like that?
It's a great question. You know, I don't think it's a one-time pad, but it might be a one-time pad. And Scheidt did say he did things to mask the English, and one-time pad is still a valid cryptographic method. It's very, very secure. If you can't find copies of those little pad sheets, you've got a secure system. I don't know. We just don't know. Okay, so I think that was the last question. I'll definitely be here to answer any other questions. I have a couple books. I have some shirts. And if I just have one takeaway is that if something is not solvable, keep at it. You know, maybe some little piece of information will be what takes something apart. But if someone keeps telling you no, don't take no for an answer. Just keep at it. All right, thank you. Enjoy DragonCon.